From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. In the wake of last week's tragic shooting deaths of five law enforcement officers in Dallas and two high-profile shooting deaths of African-American men in Louisiana and Minnesota, we'll get reaction from Florida's law enforcement community, including a legislative effort to add law enforcement officers and firefighters to the state's hate crime law. We'll also explore local community police relations, the Black Lives Matter movement, and racial tensions in Southwest Florida. Plus, as the number of cases of the Zika virus in Florida quickly approaches 300, we explored Zika research efforts, including a Florida mathematician's analysis estimating the impact of mosquito-borne versus sexually transmitted cases of the virus. We'll also learn about the New England Complex Systems Institute's response plan for Zika-impacted communities. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. The number of travel-related cases of the Zika virus in Florida is quickly approaching 300, with confirmed Zika infections and public health emergencies declared in 27 Florida counties, including Charlotte, Collier, and Lee here in southwest Florida. So far, the state has seen more than 40 cases concerning pregnant women. Zika has been linked to the birth defect microcephaly in infants born to women who've had the virus while pregnant. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be exploring Zika research efforts, including a mathematical modeling analysis estimating the impact of mosquito-borne versus sexually transmitted cases of the virus. We'll learn about the New England Complex Systems Institute's response plan for Zika-impacted communities and how exposure to an insecticide used in Brazil could be contributing to cases of microcephaly in infants there. Joining me now is Dr. Shigoy Ruan. He's a professor in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Miami, and he's behind the modeling analysis I just referenced. Dr. Ruan, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
We're also speaking with Dr. Yanir Baryam, founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute. Thanks for your time today as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I invite listeners to join the conversation. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Dr. Ruan, I wanted to begin with you. First of all, what prompted you to set your sights on looking into proliferation of the Zika virus in the first place?
I was curious about how vector-borne diseases can be transmitted sexually. So that's my starting point. I was trying to understand what happened and what is the relative importance of each mode, because usually vector-borne disease has been studied, have been studied by many people. This is the first time a vector-borne disease can be transmitted sexually. So I just try to understand what's going on here.
And I know you've also studied modeling and control of outbreaks of West Nile virus, another mosquito-borne illness. Did that background come in helpful in looking at the Zika virus?
Oh, yes, of course. We have been studying modeling West Nile virus and Rift Valley fever, malaria, and a couple others.
And as best you can, in layman's terms, can you explain how this modeling analysis works regarding Zika virus?
For vector-borne diseases, you try to understand how the interaction of mosquitoes and humans, how when mosquito bites you and the virus transmitted from mosquitoes, and then when the infected humans are bitten by a mosquito, how the virus is transmitted back to mosquito, and so on. This is a cycle which has been very well studied. And then now, on top of this cycle, you have the human-to-human transmission, which is basically from sexual active individuals can pass the virus to he or her partner. You know, currently now we understand that any man can pass the virus to women. There's no report about the vice versa transmission. So we try to include both modes into a mathematical model, try to understand the transmission dynamics. And for infectious disease, we have a terminology which is called basic reproductive number, meaning the average number of cases produced by index cases during the infectionary period. So we found out, using the data, we found out for this Zika virus, the basic reproductive number is 2, meaning on average, each infected individual can spread the disease to up to 2%, right? Which that's why the disease is out of control in Central America. We found also found the sexual transmission part contribute about 3%, which is not a whole lot, but think about the number of cases reported in Brazil, which is 150,000. 3% is a pretty big number.
Okay, I see. And this is looking specifically at data from cases in countries like Colombia, El Salvador, Brazil?
Yes, yes.
Were there other countries where you got data from as well?
There were lots of data, but I think these three are enough for us to make the conclusions.
All right. And who is it that you want to see or use the results of this mathematical modeling analysis? Is this good for public health officials to understand, you know, where they should be focusing their efforts?
Oh, sure, because at the end found out that the best way to control the outbreak is the first is mosquito control. I mean, the vector control, to kill as many mosquitoes as possible. Secondly, the personal fighting protection, you try to protect yourself, try to using repellent, wear long sleeve shirts. And also we found it is important to protect self, you know, sexually as well, especially, you know, because like in Miami, we do have the same type of mosquito, which is Aedes aegypti. But in the northern states, you know, we don't have that kind of mosquitoes, but some people is infected and can transmit sexually, then you can still have local outbreaks in the northern states. Which of course is very important for the public health often officers to make a judgment to think about, you know, different control measures.
I see. So you're saying that, you know, with sexual transmission of the virus, we could see it crop up in areas where we don't even have that species of mosquito carrying.
That's correct. Though there maybe there's no large outbreaks, but you could have local small outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Well, did you come across any findings in your research that you found surprising or that people may find surprising? Or, like, for example, did you think that the rate of sexually transmitted Zika cases would be as high as it was?
Yeah, we were a little bit surprised. We didn't know what is the percentage would be. At the beginning, we thought maybe 30%, maybe half. But no, in fact, it's not that significantly high. It's on average, it's about 3%. Yeah,
right.
which somehow is good. You know, it's not like 50%. That would be terrible.
Yeah. Then, from a public health perspective, it would be like you almost have two different emergencies because you're trying to mitigate different transmission methods. Well, as the number of Zika cases in Florida continues to grow, we're exploring Zika-related research efforts and how they can help to combat spread of the virus. We're talking with Dr. Shigoy Ruan, mathematics professor at the University of Miami, along with Dr. Yanir Baryam with the New England Complex Systems Institute. Listeners can join the conversation with comments and questions. The phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Dr. Baryam, first of all, as founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute, I was hoping you could start off by telling us about the scope of research conducted at the Institute and who utilizes it. From what I've read, the scope seems pretty broad.
Yeah, we are working on understanding collective behaviors. Collective behaviors are things that don't satisfy traditional assumptions of statistics. So there's a really very broad domain of things that we can think about. A lot of the work that we've been doing in recent years is about global crises because there are so many of them. As the world becomes interconnected, the propagation of financial, social, and disease processes becomes much more rapid. And so we see these contagion effects, not just in diseases, but in everything else that is happening. whether it's social revolutions, whether it's economic crises, or indeed pandemics.
And I know your work has had you advising government agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Are you perhaps working with the CDC at all in regards to Zika?
We are. These days, we're informing them about our work, but we don't have a lot of direct communication. The work that we did with them a number of years ago was more on health care issues. But one closely related issue that we worked with them on was on hospital-acquired infections, which has some of the same issues as we're facing now with global pandemics, in the sense that the strong interactions that take place in a hospital lead to contagion that is a circumstance for emergence of new diseases. And that's a problem that in the microcosm is echoing what's happening globally.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a bit about the response plan that the community response plan that the Institute has developed for Zika-affected communities, like once all throughout Florida. What were some of the key findings or recommendations there?
So the key here is we are very sensitive to the effect of collective behaviors, as I said, and one of the really big levers for addressing pandemics is community response. So rather than focusing on what healthcare people do, having members of the community together do things, or individually across the community do things that are effective in stopping the transmission. And in the case of mosquito-borne diseases, the key problem of getting rid of the mosquitoes is traditionally done in one of two ways, either with pesticides, which have a set of problems that we could talk about at some length, or by, in this case, draining of standing water. Because these mosquitoes tend to breed in and around the house, and they can breed in a small amount, the bottom of a cup or even smaller container of water is a place where they will lay eggs. And so one of the things that is important to do is to meticulously eliminate any standing water from in and around the house. The problem is that it's very hard to get rid of all of it. So there is a different strategy, which is to actually place standing water out so that the eggs are laid there, but to drain the water every day. It can include putting some soap in or other material that will kill the eggs. So the idea is to compete in the breeding locations with the places that the mosquitoes might breed that you cannot see, and to use that as a mechanism for rapidly decreasing the breeding of the mosquitoes. Now, this is an approach that we didn't invent. It exists in the literature. It is used in some parts of the world, but it has not been strongly implemented in the case of the Zika epidemic for reasons that I'm not clear about. It, in fact, has been pilot tested even in Brazil and shown to be effective there. So the real opportunity is not just to have it be advocated by public health authorities, but to have the community engage with it, because the more people you have that are doing this, the more effective this is. Now, in order to do it, one has to, of course, be quite careful. The best thing to do is to place out, say, 10 different small containers of water, but to number them and to make sure every day to go across all of them and drain them. If one misses one day, it's not horrendous, because it takes about a week for the eggs to mature, but it is much better if you do it every day, because then you won't miss them, and you'll make sure to kill any eggs that are laid.
You get into the habit. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Dr. Bariyama, I have to tell you, whenever we first started seeing cases of Zika in Florida and I was first reporting on it and hearing about removing standing water from around the home, how the Aedes aegypti mosquito actually prefers to breed and live sort of around residential areas as opposed to, the vast acreage of salt marsh we have around here, I cringed a little bit, because I am one of those people who are, all around my yard are bromeliads, which are plants that seem by design to collect water. And right. We're kind of getting into a time of year where it rains just about every day. So it seems like compliance could be a pretty difficult thing. Are there perhaps other methods besides spilling the water that your findings have found would be effective or would get individual community members engaged?
So the standard set of methods are to make sure that you prevent being bitten by mosquitoes by wearing appropriate clothing, by using mosquito repellent, by just taking care of the mechanisms by which you might be bit. So screens on doors and windows, of course, are important. These are daytime biting mosquitoes, so it is important to be attentive, not just in the evening when other kinds of mosquitoes are biting, but the whole time. So there's a set of recommendations that one can find on the CDC site or on our website, the possibility of responding by decreasing dramatically the mosquito population itself is the thing that we were particularly attracted to doing. Surely different places will have different success rates with doing this. If this is done in conjunction with a scientific effort, one monitors the eggs that are being laid in these artificial water sources called ovitraps, and one can see whether one is being successful in decreasing the mosquito population, which is an important thing to do.
Is that part of your recommendations as well, just having more of those ovitraps available?
Yes. And again, it's a very simple. One can take any container and make an ovitrap out of it, a small container. I do think that the best thing is to set up an organization that is engaged with the community and is monitoring what's going on, so that one can understand the effectiveness of the process and encourage people to do it as it is demonstrating itself in what it's doing. The key time to do this, of course, is there's an opportunity for it to transmit, because if we can prevent it from getting to the mosquito population in the first place, then we won't have the Zika propagating by the mosquitoes at all.
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Ryan.
Make a comment, support Dr. Bayham's recommendations. I have a collaborative from the Department of Health, Florida Department of Health, and as you mentioned that now Florida has more than 200 cases, and Miami has 75 cases. And what my collaborator told me that the current practice is that once a case is identified, the Department of Health is going to send people to the neighborhood of that person to kill all the mosquitoes to prevent the transmission from that person to the mosquitoes, the local mosquitoes. But what is really worrying is that some individuals have been infected but don't have symptoms yet, or when they come in to the country before the symptoms. So that's a possibility.
80% of people don't have symptoms that get the disease.
Exactly. But also there are some cases that people haven't shown the symptoms haven't showed yet. So there's a possibility that in that person's neighborhood, the mosquito is going to bite. It's going to bite that person. It's going to spread out, which has happened for chikungunya and dengue. So that's what the local officials are worried. So if a combination of the government's effort plus the personal measures, like taking the recommendation by Dr. Byers, like using RV traps, that might be the best recommendation, because the malaria season is going to start from late July to early September. There will be lots of mosquitoes later on.
Right. Dr. Baryan, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you also about something else the Institute has reported on, and that's about the use of an insecticide used as a mosquito control in drinking water in Brazil, and that itself could be contributing to the rise in cases of microcephaly. Can you tell us about that?
So early on in the Zika and microcephaly epidemic, there was a argument by some physicians in Brazil and Argentina that said that perhaps a new use of an insecticide in drinking water starting in the end of 2014 might be responsible for the microcephaly rather than the Zika. What we did is we looked at that possibility, while it was dismissed originally by the public health authorities, we actually found that the reasons for the dismissal were not very well justified, and as a result recommended that research be done in order to investigate it. In the meantime, one of the reasons that it was not so clear that Zika was the direct cause is because there weren't cases yet in Colombia. In only the last 3 weeks have cases shown up in Colombia that essentially confirm that Zika is a cause of microcephaly. And so up until now, we were waiting confirming information, and the reasons for investigating the pesticide pyroproxifen were very strong. Now that we do have the cases in Colombia, we surely cannot say that Zika is not a cause. But again, the reasons that the insecticide were dismissed by public health authorities did not stand up to scientific scrutiny, as far as we are concerned, and we do think that it should be investigated as a potential contributing cause. In the meantime, I don't think enough research is being done in that direction, at the same time, we surely have to face the fact that the mosquito-borne Zika is a cause and should address that problem in and of itself.
All right. Well, we certainly hope public health officials will be looking into that link more in Brazil. But that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much to my guest. Dr. Yanir Bar-Yam is the founding president of the New England Complex Systems Institute. You can read more about their work related to Zika online at necsi.edu. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've also been speaking with Dr. Shigoy Ruan, professor of mathematics at the University of Miami. Thanks for joining us as well today.
Yeah, thank you very much. My pleasure.
And there's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Chinqui and A.J. Leonard. Special thanks to WGCU's Tarek Halligan. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.